Thanks very much, Andrew, and thanks very much for having me here to talk to you today. So one aspect of the current heightened risk aversion in financial markets has been an increase in funding pressure for some banks, particularly in Europe, and so that's what I want to talk about today. So I'm going to discuss some aspects of those developments and compare and contrast the situation in Europe with that in Australia. So why should you guys, as corporate treasurers, be interested in this? First of all, at the moment, and for the last period, and it's been a major driver of volatility, and that's not going away anytime soon. Secondly, it has implications for you as corporate treasurers in terms of the price and volume and your ability to access markets. So although these pressures are primarily concentrated in the banking sector, there are clear spillovers to the rest of the financial sector. The spillovers to the corporate sector are not necessarily unambiguously negative. You've actually seen a number of instances where corporates have actually been able to take advantage of the market's dislike of anything financial, and you've seen some of the large global corporates being able to issue at significantly better terms than comparable financials. So it's not necessarily all bad news, although I think in net it probably is. So let me run through some aspects of what's going on in the bank funding market at the moment. So this is just by way of background, gives you an idea of what's been going on in share prices globally over the past 4 years and compares them to the developments in the rest of the markets. And if you look there, so I've got on the left-hand side, it's the index, the global share indices excluding banking, and on the right-hand side, it's the banking sector in the various countries I've got there. You can see now, the banking shares generally have significantly underperformed the rest of the market, and many banks are now actually trading at sizable discounts to their book value. We've seen some banks in some parts of the world, obviously some are being nationalised, so their share price has basically gone to zero, but in other parts of the world, some large, well-known banks are trading at about 90% of the value they were at, at 10% of the value that they were at in June 2007. You can also see from that graph that euro area banks have significantly underperformed banks in the rest of the world. It's also clear from that the Australian banking sector's share prices have held up reasonably well. It's actually outperformed that of other parts of the economy. We're one of the few developed countries where that's true. Canada is the other obvious example where that's true. So with the share prices as a backdrop, I'm going to focus on the funding story, which is, I think, it's basically where the market's focus is at the moment. So as the concerns about fiscal sustainability of the euro area have intensified in recent months and has spread to the financial system, that's where the increased pressure has been primarily, is on bank funding. The cost of funding for European banks generally has risen, while many banks in the European periphery countries have all but been locked out of financial markets completely and have had to rely on the state in one form or another for support. So now, as an illustration of this, this is the cost of borrowing interbank in both Europe and Australia. So what the blue line's Europe, the yellow line's Australia. It's the difference between the interbank funding costs and the equivalent expectation of the policy rate. The reason I take that out is just because as that moves around, the level of these things moves around. So the spread here gives you a reasonable idea of the tensions in the interbank market. And this graph shows that the cost of European banks borrowing from each other in short-term unsecured markets has risen to its highest level in the post-Lehman period, and that reflects the heightened counterparty concern. So you're not sure about the strength of your counterparty. By way of contrast, the equivalent spread in the Australian market, which is the yellow line, which is the spread between the bank bill rate and the expected cash rate, while higher than earlier in the year, has remained markedly lower than that in Europe, and as of at least yesterday, I don't know where it is this morning, it's back down to roughly the level it's been at for most of the past 18 months. So to try and offset the impact of that sharp increase in the cost of unsecured interbank lending for European banks, the ECB has recently announced an expansion of its open market operations. So since May last year, which is when Greece sort of hit the headlines, the ECB has stood willing to provide 3 months' funding to the banks in unlimited amounts, provided they've got acceptable collateral. So the ECB will be willing, if a bank comes to the ECB and its regular market operations, the ECB will provide funding as much as that bank wants, as long as it's got the collateral on the other side. At its most recent meeting, which was a couple of weeks ago, the ECB lengthen the maturity at which it's willing to provide this unlimited funding to the banking system to terms as long as 13 months. So, again, as long as the bank's got the appropriate collateral, it can come and borrow from the ECB, borrow euros from the ECB in unlimited amounts. So, and that's at an interest rate which is basically the policy rate, so much less than the rate they can borrow in the interbank market. So the ECB is effectively intermediating the interbank market. So it's getting around these counterparty concerns. If a bank can't borrow from another bank, it can come and borrow from the ECB. That's basically been one of the fundamental tenets of central banking, at least since the 1850s and the time of Badgett. So the ECB is standing there willing to provide unlimited funding to the banking system. So to some extent, as long as the banking system's got the right collateral, the funding issue in euros at least is effectively off the table for at least until the middle of next year, which is at this stage as long as the ECB said it's willing to continue to do this. So that take-up in short-term liquidity by banks in Europe is reflected in the expansion then of the balance sheet of the ECB. So since April this year, the ECB's lending to banks has grown by about 180 billion euro, which is about 40%, as a result of these operations, with the bulk of the increase occurring since July, as tensions have increased. So what I've got here is, it's a bit of a mess, but anyhow, that's probably reflective of what actually is happening, which is the ECB lending to banks by country. So the green line shows you the ECB's lending to Ireland, which you can see peaked earlier in the year. One of the reasons why it's come down significantly is, one, the banks in Ireland, their balance sheets are shrinking rapidly. The other thing is that the Irish Central Bank will take collateral which the ECB won't take. And so there's actually been a replacement of funding from the ECB for the Irish banks and for the Greek banks, for that matter, by lending directly from their central banks with collateral which is below the ECB's threshold. The other thing this graph shows you, particularly in the most recent months, so if you can see the spike up in lending to banks in Italy and into Spain as the crisis has spread to banks in those countries, and then in the most recent period, so this data is up until the end of September, you can see the spike in lending to banks in France, and again, that's as the markets have turned, or as the tensions have spread to banks in France. That shows the actual level of lending of the ECB to banks in these various jurisdictions. If I do it, it's not... Obviously, France is a hell of a lot bigger country than Ireland, and so to scale it by the size of the banking sectors in these countries gives you a slightly different picture. So this is what this graph does. So this is the ECB's lending to banks as a share of total banking sector assets in those countries. So what it shows you is that the ECB is providing 20% of the funding to Greek banks. As I said, the Greek central bank itself is providing another significant whack of funding. And basically the Greek banks don't access any funding directly from the markets anymore, haven't done so for probably nigh on a year now. Similar story in Ireland, similar story in Portugal. Those banks basically don't have access to the interbank markets or, in fact, to any market at the moment. But it also shows that while that lending to French banks has spiked up in the recent months, if you scale it by the share of the size of the banking system, it's not quite such a dramatic story. So that's the story for the ECB's provision of liquidity to the banking system. By way of contrast, the RBA's provision of liquidity to the Australian banking system has not changed at all in recent times. Australian bank deposits with the RBA, which is what are called exchange settlement balances, have remained around $1.25 billion for over 18 months now, which is basically the sort of normal level, if you want to describe it as such. So more generally, we have seen very little sign of any strain or counterparty concern in the local interbank market. So that's short-term funding and the funding which has been provided by the ECB. But if I look at more longer-term funding, bond issuance by banks globally has fallen sharply in recent months. So that's what this next graph shows you. So a partial, although not complete, explanation for the low level of issuance is that bank balance sheets are shrinking. The banking sector is deleveraging at the moment. So obviously they don't need as much funding as they used to. The other thing this graph shows, so this graph splits it up into secured and unsecured. It also splits it up between guaranteed and non-guaranteed, so guaranteed by the sovereign or not, or just issuing with just the strength of the bank's balance sheet behind it. So you can see in back in 08 and 09, a large amount of guaranteed issuance, a fair chunk of which is actually rolling off over the next 12 months. So that will be interesting. But you can also see the grey bits, which is covered bonds, which is the main form of secured issuance in Europe. And they've actually been the dominant form of funding by European banks over much of the course of this year. And you can see in the last few months, that's been the bulk of the issuance by European banks. So it's a covered bond issuance has actually been fairly robust for European banks, unsecured issuance much less so. And that basically reflects investors' desire to take that extra security when they're providing funding to these banks. So that's the European story. If I compare it to the Australian story, so pink here is secured issuance by Australian banks, but in Australia that takes the form of mortgage-backed securities, and then the blue is unsecured issuance. As you may all be aware, the Australian Parliament last week passed legislation permitting the issuance of covered bonds by Australian banks, and so as a result, I think we're likely to see some covered bond issuance by the local banks in the next few months, particularly given the apparent preference of global investors for this product in the current environment. So as the market volatility has increased in recent months, you can see there that the issuance by the Australian banks has also declined. As we've noted on a number of occasions, the Australian banks are much better placed to ride out these periods of volatility than they were in the past. This is for a number of reasons, including that deposit growth has outstripped and continues to outstrip credit growth by a significant margin. It's been doing that for more than 2 years now. So as deposit growth is growing faster than lending growth, it reduces the bank's need to access wholesale debt markets. In addition to that, the banks have also increased the term of their issuance, which means that on an ongoing basis they have less of a need to fund maturities. Let me just make a brief detour into the world of credit default swaps, which I assume some of you have some interest in. So a number of commentators have pointed to the large rise in CDS premia for Australian banks in recent months. Actually, over the past week, the CDS premia of the Australian banks has actually dropped quite dramatically. But the rise in CDS appears to be much larger than the rise in primary unsecured issuance costs. So a lot of people look at CDS premia and say, well, that gives me an idea about where issuance costs are going to go. But actually, there's a fairly large disconnect between the two. It's a little difficult, given the low level of issuance by Australian banks, to work out exactly where their issuance costs are at the moment. But earlier this month, the CBA issued an unsecured 3-year bond at a spread which was about 20 points wider than a similar issue earlier in the year. At the same time, its three-year CDS premium had risen by about 80 points, so it gives you some idea about the disconnect between those two. The divergence between the CDS premium and issuance costs reflects the fact that while subject to the same forces, they're not exactly the same thing. They're obviously, one's an insurance premium, the CDS is an insurance premium for default, and the other one obviously contains a premium to compensate for the risk of default, so that's reasonably similar. But there are other important elements that differ between the two. That's true for a sovereign CDS, for a financial CDS, and for corporate CDS. To further illustrate this, I think it's interesting to look at what's happened, particularly for you as corporate treasurers, to look at the CDS premium on BHP. As you may know, BHP has an extremely low gearing ratio. In fact, it basically has the same amount of cash as it has debt. At various stages last year, it actually had more cash than it had debt outstanding. So notwithstanding this fact, at one point during the past month, BHP's CDS premium had increased by as much as 110 basis points since the beginning of the year. So someone's taking out an insurance or paying for insurance on BHP defaulting on an institution which actually has more cash than it has debt. Anyhow, to give you some context around that, there are typically 2 or 3 trades in BHP CDS a day. From DTCC data, we know that there are certainly less than 50 trades per week in BHP CDS premium, CDS contracts. That is actually also true of the Australian banks and the Australian sovereign CDS, so you might also see a reasonable amount of coverage of the Australian sovereign CDS rising. Again, from what we can work out, there are basically a few trades per day in that contract, and there are actually not many outstanding at all anyhow in total. There are certainly less than 50 trades per week in that contract. So the CDS premium, the CDS contracts don't seem to have a lot of trading volume behind it. They also provide traders with a cheap way, relative to actually having to short a debt security, to take a position on the entity in question, so on BHP, or, as is reasonably evident, for both BHP and for the Australian government CDS, it's generally used as a play on China. And that's a fairly cheap way to take that position and get a reasonably healthy leveraged position on that. So after that little detour into the world of CDS premium and whether or not we should be too concerned about them, let me just return to the bank funding story. So far I've talked about banks borrowing in their own currency. So the ECB is providing euros to the banking system, we provide Australian dollars to our banking system. But European banks have also experienced a substantial increase in the cost of borrowing US dollars. And why is that relevant? It's the fact that the European banks actually have substantial US dollar asset positions still. So while the BIS data shows that these US dollar asset positions of European banks have declined since 2008, they actually remain sizable in some cases. If you saw some of the coverage around Dexia, you would see that it had a US dollar asset position of about 100 billion US dollars, so fairly sizable relative to its overall balance sheet. An important point to note is that these are US dollar assets, they're not euro dollar assets, and they require US dollar funding. Many of those assets are of long maturity, but the associated funding of those positions has tended to be at much shorter maturities. So those European banks face rollover risk both in terms of price and availability on this US dollar funding. So the European banks have a number of ways of obtaining their US dollars, including through short-term debt issuance to money market funds in particular, through US dollar offering US dollar deposits, through secured borrowing, through taking the euros, which they're able to obtain in unlimited amount, and swapping them for US dollars through the swap market, or from the Fed, or actually more directly from the ECB via central bank swap lines in US dollars. So exacerbating the Euro bank's US dollar funding pressures has been a pullback by US money market funds from holding debt issued by these banks. So what I've got here is the money market fund. This is the money market funds in the US holding of bank paper. So you can see a sharp drop in 2008, rebuilt it a bit through 2009, and then you can see from around about the time Greece came back into the picture, a rundown in funding there, picked back up again through the early part of this year, and then since about June this year, there's been a fairly precipitate drop in the funds that these money market funds have under management that they're allocating to the banking sector. So these funds invest in highly rated short-term debt, and that issued by European banks has traditionally accounted for a large share of their assets. So the majority of this rundown has actually been reflected in reduced holdings of European bank debt. So notably, these funds hold no or negligible amounts of debt issued by banks in Greece, Ireland, Italy, Portugal and Spain. So as of around the middle of the year, the holdings of these guys of debt from banks in those countries has basically gone to zero. They've also shortened the average maturity of those of their asset holdings. In the most recent period, the biggest decline has actually been in their holdings of French bank paper, and they're particularly shortened up, not willing to let offer terms much more than a week to those banks. So as these and other sources of funding in US dollars have diminished for the European banks, they've increasingly sought to obtain US dollars via foreign exchange swaps. So as I said earlier, they've got pretty much as much euros as they want to get from the ECB. They can then go and try and swap them into US dollars. So this graph here tells you how much it's costing them to swap euros into US dollars. So this is the basis for a three-month swap. So you can see it's spiking up to around 100 basis points earlier in the year. I've given you the equivalent price for swapping Australian dollars into US dollars. And you can see that actually we haven't experienced anything like that. In fact, at the moment, it's the other way around in Australia. It's actually cheaper to go the other direction for at least 3 months in Australia. You can see in the European case that it's risen to its highest level since the peaks post Lehman. So to counter the impact of this, in addition to being sourcing more US dollars, some banks are tapping US dollar repo markets for funding. So the money market funds are traditionally lent to these European banks unsecured. Now these European banks are looking to tap US dollar markets through secured sources. Reportedly, in some cases, with quite significant haircuts applied to the assets that they're providing as collateral against those repos. These banks, the European banks, are also actively looking to reduce their US dollar asset positions, which is causing a drop in, one of the reasons why they haven't been able to sell these US dollar assets is because no one particularly wants them. Now they're trying to sell them at even cheaper prices, see if anyone's willing to take them. But in a world where the global banking system is delivering, you're finding it hard to find a buyer. So the European banks also appear to have built up cash buffers in US dollars earlier in the year. So cash holdings of foreign banks in the US, which a reasonable share of which are European, have risen to over $1 trillion US dollars from less than $400 billion US dollars earlier this year. In the recent months, they've started to decline as the European banks have used some of that funding to replace, have run down some of that funding as other sources of funding have dried up. But one important reminder from the financial crisis, or the peak of the financial crisis, was that central banks can significantly help market functioning when liquidity strains emerge. So as I mentioned earlier, the European banks can access liquidity in their own currencies, in euros, effectively in unlimited amounts, as long as they've got the right collateral. But to fund US dollar asset positions, they need US dollars, not euros. So euros are useful if the swap market's functioning. This suggests that if the swap market isn't functioning or at least it's getting expensive for people, there are reasonable indications that some banks are basically shut out of this market completely. Certainly in 2008, the swap market effectively shut down pretty much across the world. In response to that, in 2008, the Federal Reserve initiated swap lines with other central banks. What happens there is the Fed provides US dollars to the ECB, swapped against euros. So the Fed's exposure is to the ECB. The ECB then in turn lends out its US dollars that it's got under the swap from the Fed to banks in its own jurisdiction, again against collateral. So the ECB is the one wearing the credit risk. The Fed's credit risk is only against the ECB. So those swap lines, which were put together in 2008, effectively provided unlimited US dollar funding to the banks in other jurisdictions, again, provided they had the right collateral. The swap lines ran off in early 2010 as those pressures there dissipated, and while the central banks maintained them at seven-day terms after that, the major central banks did that, they were barely utilised. Just recently, again, in last month, three-month terms were reintroduced by the major central banks. But despite those tensions evident in that basis there, recourse to these central bank swap lines with the Fed has been negligible. So the last week, the ECB auctioned US dollars at a three-month term, which takes you over the year end. The take-up was only $1.4 billion, and only six banks actually were interested in taking up the funding from the ECB. Notwithstanding the apparent lack of interest in it, the ECB and other major central banks are going to conduct another three-month auction both in November and December, just to try and make sure that those strains are contained. The price that the banks have to pay to borrow from the ECB is actually 100. On this graph here, it would be 100. So you can see if you can access the market, it's actually cheaper to access it from the market than from the ECB. So as you can see here, though, this issue isn't hitting our banks this time around. In 2008, we did see a significant widening in the basis as the funding pressures emanating from Europe spilled right across the globe. So this time around, though, we're not seeing that. One of the reasons for that is there are some fundamental differences in the nature of the Australian banks' offshore funding. The funding that our banks raise offshore, which is mostly in US dollars, is swapped back into Australian dollars to fund Australian dollar assets. The euro banks raise US dollars to fund US dollar assets. Our banks raise funding in US dollars. They swap them back into Australian dollars at the same maturity to fund Australian dollar assets. So if our banks experience increased difficulty in accessing US funding markets, ultimately that can be resolved by sourcing Australian dollar liquidity because they have to fund Australian dollar assets, not foreign currency assets. In particularly stressed circumstances, they can source that liquidity from us, from the Reserve Bank. So, as I said, the other point of contrast in terms of US dollar funding pressures is that, in contrast to the experience of the European banks, we've seen a significant rundown in funding from money market funds. Our banks have actually been beneficiaries of that, along with other banking systems like the Canadian banking system. So we've actually seen over the last 3 to 6 months our banks actually finding the money market funds trying to lend even more money to them as they divert funding away from the European banks. So the situation here, or for our banks at least, is quite in stark contrast to that in Europe. So let me conclude. What I've tried to do today is to give you some idea around an issue which is fairly central to the volatility in financial markets at the moment. Obviously, the sovereign issue is probably the most central issue, but the banking funding issue is heavily related to it and another major source of volatility. So the banking system globally has been under scrutiny in terms of its funding for much of the past 4 years. We're obviously in a period of heightened scrutiny right at the moment. The actions by the ECB, together with the Fed, through the provision of effectively unlimited euros, and then together with the Fed effectively providing unlimited US dollars to the European banking system, should take some of these funding issues off the table for the period ahead. Obviously, capital issues are still at the fore as well. What I've tried to, the point I'm trying to get across today is that the funding strains are certainly there, but the central banks, through following some of their sort of core principles of central banking, are able to alleviate those funding strains to a reasonable extent. I've also provided some comparison with the situation facing the Australian banks. As I said, we are not seeing any of the same sort of stresses for the Australian banks that are present for some of the European banks. The Australian banks' funding structures are considerably more resilient to periods of stress markets than they were previously, given the changes that have occurred over the past few years. So I think we should at least take some comfort for that. So let me leave it there. Thanks.
Let's kick off by asking, I'm just going to ask the first question, and please do stand up, put your hands up. I'm going to ask, what are the sorts of things that have made you have your less, or not necessarily kept you awake at night, but made you have a bit of an uneasy night's sleep over the last few months in relation to the global economy?
Well, I get kept awake every night by volatility. So,
is that just because you have to watch the market?
For 4 years now, actually. So I wouldn't even pick the last few months. A combination of volatility and young kids.
Here's a very important question. Which is worse? Global economy, volatility, or young kids at keeping you awake at night?
No, volatility, definitely.
Definitely?
Yes.
Okay, so it's pretty serious then.
Oh, well, no, my kids don't know how to ring me on the phone in the middle of the night, whereas my officers in New York and London do.
So. One of the things I want to ask everybody in the room to respond to very shortly, and I will ask you to respond to this now, you must be conscious at various times of decisions that you make day to day, advice that you give people day to day, do have the impact of influencing decision makers who could potentially make a simple mistake where we would be looking at a very, very seriously large sum of money. Are you more concerned about the ramifications of the advice that you give at this point in time? Does it worry you at a personal level?
I don't think worry is the right word. I mean, you obviously got to be mindful, working in an institution like the one I work at, that the decisions that the board takes, which I advise the board, so it's the board's decision, not ultimately mine, but the decision that the board takes has a material impact on the welfare of the country as a whole. In fact, that's actually part of our act, is that we are supposed to be mindful of that, and you are mindful of that. So it's certainly something I think everyone at our organisation takes extremely seriously. We're very mindful of the fact that the decisions we make have a material impact on how the country functions.
Perhaps to Guy, I'm actually happy that you're kept awake at night thinking about these issues, because I think that's one of the themes that in Australia, anyhow, we take comfort from, is that we've got a well-run Reserve Bank and we've got a system of banks that are very well behaved, and probably that's part history, but that's all part good management. But the question is, you know, thinking about these risks that you outlined with the European banking system, and thinking of perhaps a scenario where the Australian banks have to look increasingly towards the liquidity in the domestic market. You mentioned, I think, that the Reserve Bank is well placed to assist in providing that liquidity, but in a structural sense, do you think that this is going to lead to a scenario where banks source more funding in the long term from Australia, and what kind of side implications does that have, given that we've got a potential for crowding out of funds in Australia?
The banks actually are sourcing more funds domestically, but primarily through deposits, and I don't think I would regard. I mean. It's hard to say. I think it's hard to say that the banking system crowds out uh, other corporates from the funding market, because the banking system is primarily raising this funds to intermediate it by and then on lend it to roughly 50-50 to the household sector and to businesses. So I don't think you necessarily would regard the banks as crowding out corporates. I do think there is a more broad issue, and Mike Baird touched on this in his presentation, which is in terms of domestically sourced funding, is the allocation that particularly the institutional sector gives to fixed income versus equity. Now, that's relevant for the corporate sector and being able to source funds domestically in terms of the domestic bond market. The government's obviously got some interest in that and is looking at policies around that, but I think that in a medium-term sense, that's a fundamental issue for the for people in this room as to the ability to source funds directly rather than necessarily intermediated through the banking system.
And there's a question very much associated that's been texted in. Is the Reserve Bank happy with the continued increase in saving and falling credit growth in Australia?
Are we more comfortable that the household sector is saving more than it used to? Yes. So that I think makes the economy more resilient. I think we are in a world where credit growth is likely to be slower than it was through the 90s, certainly in the earlier part of this decade going forward. I mean, you want some level of credit growth to support the growth in the economy. So there is a level at which you would certainly be comfortable for that to be growing, and including to the particularly to the corporate sector. I mean, business lending to the intermediated lending to the business sector is close to flat at the moment, has been for a while. You would expect to see that growing somewhat faster than it is at the moment in to support growth in the medium term.
My question was for Guy. Guy, you did discuss in some detail how the ECB has been managing the funding issues over in Europe. And, of course, we've seen the central banks globally particularly active over the last couple of weeks, whether it be the Fed with Operation Twist or the BOE with more quantitative easing. I guess I see these measures as more managing the situation rather than solving it. And I wondered what your views were on what we need to do to solve the situation and how optimistic you are about anything good coming out of these meetings that the market's anticipating over the next few weeks out of Europe.
Solving it is an incredibly difficult question. There are a lot of people around the world try to do their best to try and solve the situation, and we are where we are. I would agree with your characterisation. The central banks can only do so much, particularly in Europe and Europe and the US, and the ultimate responsibility lies elsewhere, but primarily actually with the political process in both countries. And that's what's potentially coming to a head on the weekend. At least there's some expectation that's going to come to a head on the weekend in Europe as to whether they can put together a rescue plan. I think the situation is going to come to a head in Europe sometime in the fairly near future, one way or the other, but I think that's completely unpredictable, because ultimately it's a political decision, and trying to predict political decisions, particularly in Europe, where you've actually got to predict 17 political decisions at least, is close to impossible.
It's actually a question for Guy. Two parts. What do you see as the long-term viability of the EU in its current format? And on a totally different question, but I'll ask it while I'm still standing, is with the introduction of covered bonds, how is that? What do you see that as the immediate impact with the introduction of covered bonds for our banking system here?
On the first one, I don't know. As I said, it's a political decision. Both for the politicians, but also for the people in these different countries. And obviously, in Greece, most obviously, but also in places as diverse as Finland and Slovakia, you are seeing different political parties come to the fore with different views as to the future of Europe than than those parties which are currently in power. So how that plays out, I think, again, is impossible, is really impossible to predict. On the much more straightforward question in terms of covered bonds, as I said earlier in my speech, there's a reasonable appetite for those sort of products across investors offshore. I'm not sure that there'll be that much appetite for investors onshore because I think they're pretty comfortable with the mortgage-backed security product. Covered bonds tend to be issued at a tighter spread than MBS, even though mostly because there's an extra level of security. My guess is the domestic market is probably going to be happy just taking that higher spread on MBS. Offshore, where they're much more familiar with covered bonds, have been around for a few hundred years in some countries, so the investors there are much more familiar with them. My guess is the banks will be primarily using them to tap funding in offshore markets. We've seen they've been around in New Zealand now for most of this year. All of the New Zealand banks have now, obviously most, basically all of which are owned by Australian banks, have all issued one in the fairly recent past without much drama. So I would expect that you would see become a reasonable part of the Australian banks' funding strategy over the period ahead.
It's a question for Guy DeBell. This is a lot easier than some of the other questions, I might add. Is it reasonable to assume, given what we've mentioned here about the global economy, that the banks are going to face greater funding pressures next year? Because I note that deposits are not a particularly cheap form of funding. Is it reasonable then to assume that people might expect some increase in interest rates, unilateral increase in interest rates either to households or businesses? And then is it reasonable to assume that you're keeping an eye on that sort of thing in your monetary policy deliberations?
Well, as you know, Phil, we always keep an eye on that sort of thing in our monetary policy deliberations. At the moment, as I said earlier, it's actually difficult to tell what's happening with funding costs. And part of it comes to the point as to where you think things are going to go over the next little while, which I think is very difficult to say. On the deposit front, actually, because deposit growth remains rapid and much faster than balance sheet growth, or credit growth at least, it's actually, you're seeing some of the deposit rates actually come down rather than up. I'm sure you guys as corporate treasurers and the deposits that you're placing with the banks has probably seen some of those attractive offers disappear a bit in the last few months. So that source of pressure is actually easing. On the lending rate front, you've actually seen a number of fixed interest rate loans come down, both for mortgages, but also for various parts, for corporate lending as well. You've actually seen some reduction there.